Episode 248, What the Fountain?
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono. And we're back.
Back to discuss a movie I just watched.
Yeah.
And you've seen how many times, you think?
Oh, gosh. At least 10.
So before 10?
I'm sure I've seen it 10 times.
So before you listen a moment further, you should know we're going to be discussing, in spoilerific fashion, the movie The Fountain.
But I was thinking about this.
Starring Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
Directed by Darren Aronofsky. So, like I mentioned in the last episode, you can go watch it on Amazon for $1.99. Or you can rent it. Otherwise,
not. But if you have not seen it, you should listen anyway, because spoilers don't spoil this movie.
That's probably true.
This movie is much more of an experience, and you'll probably be really confused after you finish watching it for the first time anyway, so having a little help going in won't hurt a thing.
This was my experience in preparation for the episode. Watched it on Sunday,
yeah.
Didn't think about it, or didn't do anything with it on Monday, and today read some articles about it.
Okay.
To try to understand it more.
Yeah.
I've been
thinking about what this movie means for the better part of a decade.
Let me give my initial reactions, and I don't want you to be disappointed.
Can I? Oh, I see. I was going to predict you. I didn't think you liked it.
It's not that I didn't see the artistic value in it.
Yeah.
But it just is such a downer. I know, maybe I'm just looking at it too surface level, but because it really revolves around the death of his wife.
Yeah.
And because I don't know, recently married and now experiencing what it's like to be a husband, and just thinking about that for my own life and how it actually just made me feel kind of uncomfortable, because it's dealing so squarely with death and losing somebody close early that it just made me feel sad to think about losing Dez.
Wouldn't that seem to indicate that it's a successful movie then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Successful movie. It did hit me.
Right.
But it wasn't an enjoyable experience.
I see.
Okay.
See, I think it's actually an incredibly hopeful movie. And very encouraging and uplifting.
And so, you're going to do most of the talking, I'm sure, for this episode. Let me get out some of my initial thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. I want to hear what you thought
about
it. So,
Dez, when she got home that night, asked me what I thought about the movie, because I told her I was watching it for the podcast.
Had she seen it before?
No, she hasn't.
No.
I told her I didn't really like the experience, but I tried to sum up to her what I thought the movie was about. So, I'm just going to tell you my initial reaction.
Yeah, because I did not understand this movie at all the first time I saw it.
Okay, so this is, I wrote it down so I wouldn't mess it up. Here we go. This is what I think the theme is, especially with that.
I want to hear what you think the theme is, but also I want to hear you say what you think happens in the movie.
Okay.
Because it's very confusing.
So death is the road to awe.
Yeah.
That's like a big statement in here. So I think that what it was saying is that dying is not the end. That's how I took it away.
Okay.
That's what I took away from it, is that she was trying to tell him she's okay with it, and I felt like at the end of the movie, we saw them meet back up in the afterlife, possibly.
Hmm.
And so,
I mean, that's certainly one way you could interpret it.
Yeah, so death is not the end.
Okay.
That's my initial interpretation, and we can discuss it and maybe find out more about, more about what is maybe actually happening. So now you want me to tell you what I think happened?
Yeah. So what happened? So we've got those three storylines. For those who maybe haven't seen the movie, or it's been a while, you've got one 500 years in the past with a Spanish conquistador searching for the circle of life, or the tree of life.
Yep.
You've got one in the present with Tom, the neurosurgeon, trying to save his wife who's dying of brain cancer. And you have one in the future of Tom.
500 years.
Yeah.
So it's Tomas, Tom, and Tommy. Did you know that?
Yep.
That's what they're online anyways.
That's what Wikipedia says.
Exactly. okay, so this is, aside from my Wikipedia knowledge that I now have, this is just initially what I thought happened.
Okay.
So you've got it opens with the conquistador. Actually, I took some notes along the way. It opens with the conquistador scene, but you eventually find out that that's just her writing of a book.
Okay.
And I think she's trying to, okay, let me try to get this all out. I'm not positive why she was writing a story. I mean, I read some articles about maybe why she was.
Right.
But upon my first viewing, I wasn't certain, is it just as a coping mechanism? Is she trying to tell him something? Or is it something more supernatural where when she asks him to write that final chapter, that he's going to have some sort of revelation and she knows this somehow, like maybe with some precognition, she knows he's going to have a better understanding of how this is supposed to end after her death.
Right.
Okay, so anyways, so I don't think the conquistador scenes were real, but then by the end of the movie, they tied to what I think is reality. So let me continue
on. That's what's confusing. Yeah.
So then we've got the modern day, present day scenes.
Yeah.
So I would think that this is probably the thing that's really happening. And the scenes where he's floating in that bubble.
Right.
And you said 500 years in the future. I don't know that I consider it that a scene that's in the future so much as I think he might be dead in that scene.
Okay.
And that he's traveling maybe in some sort of purgatory type realm, or he's traveling to his afterlife.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I think that when he doesn't, at the end, he meets back up with her. She's standing by that tree. And she hands him a piece of fruit, or like I thought of it as Adam and Eve. Like she handed him a piece of fruit.
Good. You should.
But then it kind of seemed like it was more of a seed because he planted it. Yes. I thought it was a fruit at first. And I thought maybe he'd eat it, but then he plants it. And then it's like time wise, there's no real solid stream because all of a sudden the person that plants the seed isn't the future version of him. It's the modern day version.
Yes.
And also there's the part where the conquistador becomes the first father. So we've heard this Mayan myth about the first father, about how a like tree grows out of his body.
Yeah.
And the conquistador has that happen to him somehow.
Right. He eats from the tree of life, and instead of becoming immortal, he essentially has trees sprout out of him.
Yeah. And the conquistador and the bald version of Tom are connected somehow.
Yes.
Because the priest, the Mayan priest, sees the conquistador and then has a vision of him as the bald version we've seen in the bubble.
Yes.
But that's not really what's actually there. We know it's really just the conquistador there. He's just seeing him differently.
Possibly.
I think.
I mean, I think it's important to understand with this movie that there isn't necessarily one right answer to it.
Yeah.
Kind of like what we saw with Noah, where one of the things that frustrated me with the Christian response to it was that there was a real tendency to want to assign definitive meanings to every symbol in the movie.
Yeah.
And when we did our episodes, like we were talking about the snake skin, we came up with a good four or five different possible meanings that are all supported by the film. And that's very much the case here. You can read this a lot of different ways. And I think your reading of future Tom as a sort of purgatory is a really interesting one, and one I haven't heard before.
One last thing a few more things I want to say before you take over. So the whole movie opens with a Bible verse.
Yes.
Which is interesting. And it really reminded me, even the way it looked reminded me of Noah. I'm not positive about this, so correct me if I'm wrong. The seed that he plants in the grave is the same seed that Noah planted
in
Noah. Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
So that's pretty cool.
That is really
because
cool.
Because in Noah, it springs up. In Noah,
Methuselah gives Noah this seed that's from Eden.
Yeah, let me read my note about this. It's I just wrote this. The seed that Jackman plants in the snow at the end of the movie is the same type of seed that Methuselah gave Noah to plant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Both seeds.
But they did different things, right?
Did they?
Well, we didn't see what it does the fountain.
Are you sure?
Okay, hold on. Let me think back. In Noah, it becomes a river? Or what does it become?
It becomes that whole forest that Noah builds the ark out of.
Okay, and then
It essentially revives a portion of Eden.
Oh, and then in the fountain, it becomes the new tree of life?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
That's in the spaceship.
Oh, it becomes the one that we see in the spaceship?
Possibly. That's one reading.
I don't think that's true. Because that scene where he plants it happens after the spaceship.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. Because he's in the bubble, and then the tree dies. But then he goes through... I'm just trying to reimagine it. He goes through that whole supernova business, the nebula, and then he's now dead also, and that's when he's seen her by this tree, and she hands him the seed, and this is future Bald Tom, and then all of a sudden, he's back at her grave, and he plants it then. So it's after the bubble scene.
Well, that would be one interpretation, but you're forgetting that scenes from the past constantly reappear in future Tom.
Yeah.
He's constantly having visions of things that happened before, so you could also read it as if that's something that happened in present day Tom's story, and he's now seen a vision of greater understanding.
But who handed him the seed then in the past?
I'll get there.
Okay.
Because that's an interesting point. And again, not a right answer.
Okay.
So
why do you think she calls the book that she's writing The Fountain, which is where the movie gets its name, when it seemed like you want to call it the Fountain of Life, but we're talking about the Tree of Life?
Yeah, I mean, at the end, when Tomas gets to the top of the Mayan pyramid, it's very much the Tree of Life within the Fountain of Life. So it's a conflation of two different symbols of immortality.
Okay, so, all right. I've got some notes here from just like my research and my initial note-taking while I was watching the movie.
Yeah.
So you take it away, and then I'll add things in.
Okay. So what I have then is, obviously we'll talk about themes and stuff throughout. I want to get into some more parallels of Noah later on. I want to share with you a bit, but what we'll do here, what I want to do at the beginning then, is I have several symbols I want to get into as well that are very fascinating in this movie. But I want to kind of talk about what's going on in these three storylines. I'm going to give you what I consider to be the most straightforward, sensical reading of this movie. And then I'll throw out a few different alternative, more confusing, more contradictory readings that are maybe a bit more artistic and each has their own merits.
Okay.
So we have three storylines that are really in some ways the same storyline. Okay?
Yes, I agree.
So past, we have Tomas is seeking to save Queen Isabella from conquest and Spain from conquest. The villain in the past storyline is the Inquisitor.
The Grand Inquisitor?
Yes. The hope is the Tree of Life, and the outcome is death as Tomas gets to the Tree of Life, eats of it, but then also rebirth as...
He becomes the First Father. A First Father?
No, Tomas doesn't become the First Father.
They call him the First Father.
No, he doesn't. He calls future Tom the First Father.
Okay.
That's going to be important. We'll get there.
Okay.
At least that's...
Oh, so yeah. Do you think that the future bald version is actually the distant past?
That's another way you could read it.
I mean, is that what you're getting at or not?
No, not yet.
Okay.
We'll get there. So outcome, death, and rebirth. Present day Tom is seeking to save Izzy through his work. The villain in this case is brain cancer. The hope is neuroscience and medicine. And the outcome is, again, death and possibly rebirth.
Wait, the outcome of the first one, why do you think that was death? Because
when he eats of the tree, it kills him.
But Izzy doesn't die, or the queen.
Well, by implication, she does, because he isn't able to succeed in his quest.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep.
Right.
And then in the future, Tom is seeking to save the tree from its death.
Mm-hmm.
And here the villain is essentially just time, entropy, old age. The tree is literally wearing out.
And the tree is symbolic of Izzy.
Yes, and life in general.
But he's caring for the tree the same way he cares for Izzy, right?
Yeah, the tree, there's very strong visual parallels between the tree and Izzy. Like when he goes in to kiss Izzy at one point, you see the kind of the neck hairs stand up a little bit.
Yeah.
The same thing happens on the tree when he gets close to it. Exact same visual. The hope is getting to Xibalba. So future Tom's hope is that he gets to
Xibalba.
The nebula. When it explodes, it will somehow grant new life to him and the tree.
Okay.
And the outcome again is death and rebirth. He dies in Xibalba exploding and is subsequently reborn.
How do you know that?
That's what the final shot of the movie is.
What was the final shot? Remind me.
Everything, Xibalba is exploding and there's new stars and new worlds being created all over the place, and he's a part of that.
He is what? He is a star?
He is.
But his human form dies.
Yeah. But he's reborn somehow.
Okay.
Okay, so here's your straightforward reading. The movie begins, not as the movie, but the story would begin in the present day. Izzy's dying of cancer. Tom's trying to find a cure. She accepts her fate that she's going to die. He can't. So what she does is she begins writing this book called The Fountain to explain it to him. You were right on that. As far as this, and again, this isn't like there's multiple interpretations, but for the most straightforward, basic reading would be the Inquisitor then in the book is a metaphor for her cancer. It's overwhelming Spain, just as the cancer is overwhelming her. She portrays Tomas in the most favorable light, whereas future Tom and present Tom are seen as fairly desperate characters who are in fairly large states of denial. Tomas is seen as a very noble character, so she's projecting the most generous, positive version of him into her story. Okay? He fails in his quest despite that, or at least seems to, so she's telling him that, look, you're doing this and it's good, but it's not going to work ultimately. And then she leaves the final chapter for him to write, knowing that it's going to force him to actually accept her death in order to write it. He's going to have to accept the reality of death. Mm. Okay. So then Izzy dies, and Tom has his speech about how death is a disease, and I'm going to go find a cure. He plants the seed over her grave. He gets the seed from the tree in Central America where they got the medicine that was curing the monkey.
Okay. So how do you know that?
That's what the interpretation would be. Okay. We don't know that for sure. We're making a little bit of a leap here. So what the interpretation would be is that at the end when we see her handing the seed, that's his understanding of that she is guiding him to go and get this seed from there. He plants it over her grave.
Okay.
Okay? In a sense, then, she becomes a form of first father. So as the seed springs up, her essence is absorbed into it.
Okay.
Okay? Because you remember that she tells the story of this guy Moses, the Mayan guy. When they're in the museum, she makes a reference to this guy Moses, who she knew, who was immersed in the Mayan religion and requested that his aunts or his children plant the seed over his grave because he believes then that he will become a part of the tree and live on after death through that. Okay. So Tom does that. The tree, it grows into a new tree of life. So that tree in Central America is essentially the tree of life.
Okay, so it is.
It is the tree actual, of life.
So yes. That is Eden.
That is, they found something Eden-esque. Yeah. Okay. And so new tree of life that springs up that has Izzy as part of it. Through eating the tree of life, Tom continues on into the future. So he literally lives 500 years into the future.
Okay, I did consider that.
Okay.
That it was the exact same guy who has lived that long.
Right.
Okay.
The tree then eventually begins to die, so Tom takes it on the spaceship to Xibalba, where he believes it will be reborn when Xibalba explodes, and he believes that based on things Izzy says about Xibalba. Well, on the way there, he has these frequent flashbacks and visions of his life with Izzy, where he has to constantly relive his failure, his choice to not spend his time with her, but rather researching this medicine, and essentially accept the fact that he failed her when she needed him the most. The tree dies right before it reaches Xibalba.
Oh, which is the same thing that happened to her.
Exactly. And so then he realizes he has failed again, and this time he's lost her for good. So this is his last...
Because she died right when they may have found a cure.
Exactly. Exactly. This sends him into complete despair, and then through one final vision of her, he accepts the fact... he finally accepts the reality of death. He accepts his own death, and he is able to finish the story.
What was the vision of her?
He sees a vision of the queen, Isabella, so he's, which is symbolic of him. The reason it's the vision of the queen and not of her is that part of his accepting of death is getting back into the story. He has to get back into that and finish it. So he sees the queen, and then they're talking, and he says, "I'm going to die," and there's a relief in his voice, and he accepts it. He goes and finishes the story. He writes himself into the story to get Tomas out of the pretty much impossible situation that he's in, where Izzy leaves it, where the guy's swinging the sword at him, because that's the last thing Izzy wrote. And then, but also to thematically place himself there as recognizing that he's simultaneously the last man, but also going to be the first father, because through him, this new life, new universe is going to be created through the explosion of Xibalba, and he'll become a part of that.
Okay, so the part where the conquistador has the trees spring out of him, that's his writing.
Yes.
The story.
That's him finishing the story.
So the reason that he appears.
Death. Yeah.
What is that supposed to symbolize?
That's where he begins writing the story. And he writes it as saying that he realizes now, you know, all the parallels, that that's him in the story. So the guard sees him, recognizes that he is first father, because as the last man, he's also the first man, because there's this whole secular history thing going on in the story.
Can I ask you about the question? So you said that he had the vision of the queen right before he died.
Yeah.
In most of the visions, he saw her all in white with the white jacket, the white hat.
Yep.
But there, he did keep having this one flashback where she was kind of drawing him towards her when she was in a red dress and long hair. So it was before her
pre-cancer.
Yeah, pre-cancer. What are we supposed to make of that? Because nothing came of that scene. It just
it's symbolic of their happiness and their life together before cancer came in. That's what he wants to get back to.
Okay.
That's what he's trying the entire movie to get back to, is that scene. So that's his goal, but it's an unreachable goal.
What's the with her being all in white, what's that supposed to say to us?
Oh, man, we'll get there in a second.
Okay.
Okay, because that gets into the symbolism of the movie.
Okay.
So then the final thing that happens is Xibalba explodes. It kills Tom and the tree, but through that death, he and the tree are reborn. They become the first father, so to speak, of this new galaxy.
Okay. Well, that's kind of cool. Yeah, I didn't get that.
It's a complex movie.
Okay. All right, so you said that that's the most straightforward reading.
Yeah, and I think it's probably in a lot of ways the best one. Other readings would be that all three stories are true, and what's happening is these two characters are being reincarnated again and again and again, and having various visions of their past lives along the way. So the reason she's writing the book is that she's actually remembering their former lives and trying to get them to a point where they can accept it.
And the tattooing on his arm, then, that would be symbolizing just how much time has passed?
No.
Because like, I saw the tattooing, you know, because it's rings.
Yes.
It's the same thing as with rings on trees, where it shows how much time has passed. You can look at the rings of the trees. And so if you are saying that that guy lived for 500 additional years, then that would be a good sign of how much time has passed.
It could be, though the tattoos begin with when he loses his wedding ring.
Yes. So go ahead. What are you saying then?
Well, let's come back to that, because I want to talk about that more in symbols. So reincarnation would be one possible explanation. And what vouches for this is that in the first storyline, the past one, both Tom and both Tomas and Queen Isabella are fighting against death. You know, she wants him to go on this quest. He goes on the quest.
Mm-hmm.
In the present storyline, she's now accepted death. He hasn't. In the future storyline, they've both accepted death, ultimately. So you see the progression of their characters through that. Another reading would be that only the present is real. Mm-hmm. So the past, which would be similar to your reading, I suppose. The past is the book. And then the future is, you mentioned purgatory. The future could be a visualization of Tom's grieving process.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a portion of the book as well that she also wrote, because she makes that comment that it begins in Central America and it ends at Xibalba.
Mm.
So she makes that kind of interesting comment that's kind of a bit difficult to fit into an interpretation of the movie.
Yeah,
that one's a little tough because there is so much there that is particular to the present storyline of the visions in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I suppose you could postulate that maybe Tom is, again, through his grieving process, is writing those portions of the book as well. And then you could also look at it as that they're just three completely separate stories and they have no connections whatsoever, which is what some people looked at, and most people who took that interpretation were very dissatisfied with the movie.
Which interpretation do you take, the first one that you read through?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't think it's one where you have to, like, commit to one interpretation of this movie. I like that one. I like the reincarnation storyline. I think there's a lot of different interesting ways to read this movie. I like what you said about kind of the purgatory thing, where he's now in this middle state and he has to accept the reality of death before he moves on to the afterlife. So, yeah, I mean, as far as, like, if you just want a coherent story out of this thing, I think the first thing I read through is probably your best bet.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's good. It would bring in, because I know that Aronofsky has said that he considers this a sci-fi movie, but with a lot of heart.
Yeah.
And so if you're saying that 500 years actually did pass, then that would bring in the sci-fi element. Whereas I'm viewing it as more spiritual. He's literally in a spaceship.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, it just really depends on how you want to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So should we get into some symbols?
Yeah, this is what I'm excited about.
Okay.
I'm also excited to see the tie-ins to Noah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We already hit on one of the big ones with the seed. I mean, that didn't click for me until I was watching it again today. And I was, oh my gosh, that's the same seed.
Yeah. Did you look it up to see if that was true?
I tried to. I couldn't find anything for sure, but I'm 99% sure. With as far as I can be without actually going back and looking at Noah, certainly very similar. Well, so
when you start looking for, or when you start reading through the symbols, I'm just going to quickly Google ties between the movies.
I already did. There's nothing on it out there.
Okay, good. Maybe so we're the first one.
We're the first one to make that tie.
Okay, perfect.
So there's Eucharistic symbols throughout this movie, especially in the future storyline.
Oh, when he's taking the...
Exactly.
Like, almost like a communion, when he's taking the piece of...
Exactly like a communion.
So he takes the bark and he puts it... Yep, okay.
Gotcha. Yep. Which, if you think about in Catholic theology, the Eucharist is literally a form of life coming into you. You know, and so it's very similar.
If it is a symbol of Izzy, he's literally eating a part of her body.
Exactly. It's very much of somebody who's resurrected, even more so down that way, because she has died and then essentially come back in a new form of life as a tree.
Interesting.
So, yeah, we're very much supposed to take Eucharistic overtones from those scenes of him constantly as he's eating of the tree of life in the future. The ring is very important because he's constantly he loses it twice in both of the past storylines.
He lost it when he was going to perform the surgery,
mm-hmm.
and then the big one that he got in as a conquistador. Where did he lose that?
Right at the end, she gives it to him at the beginning as a symbol of, you know, his quest.
Mm-hmm.
He reaches the tree of life. He eats it. He drinks from its sap. And then he's about to put on the ring, and he starts to transform.
Oh,
and
that's when he spasmed.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And so he's constantly losing the ring. So that's an interesting symbol. Any thoughts on why does he lose the ring?
Let's see. Well, circles are forever.
You sure?
So, and this whole thing is about dying, and depending on what his view, Aronofsky's view is on the afterlife being a permanent place, it could be that in every timeline that he can't put the ring on, it's a timeline where he can't come to terms with everlasting life afterwards. So that's my take.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. I think you have to see the ring as a bond between him and Izzy.
Yeah.
And in both the Conquistador storyline and the present day storyline, he loves her, but his quest for immortality, his unwillingness to accept death, keeps him from her.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that, you know, constant scenes in the present day storyline where instead of spending time with her, he's in the lab, he's, you know, researching this project to try and save her.
In one version, at the end, he does choose her.
Exactly. And that's when he puts on the ring.
And what's that? When is that happening? Is that symbolic? Is that in his mind, or is that in the afterlife?
Well, that's a good question. I would take it as more symbolic.
If you go with my theory, you could say that that's his way of going into the afterlife.
You could. Both of them work. But yeah, that's when he's able to put on the ring. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense where he loses the ring because he becomes unworthy of it. He's not able to actually love her and be with her because he's not able to accept death. He doesn't accept death because he wants to be with her, but paradoxically it prevents him from being with her.
Interesting.
So then we see present Tom tattoo this ring onto his finger. And you mentioned the whole, then in the future Tom, we see ring tattoos all the way down his arm. And it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it as like rings on a tree, though that certainly could be. I took it as more that he's desperately trying to make up for that lost ring.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he's now overcompensated to the point of filling his arm with these ring tattoos, he still hasn't found it.
Did you not see it also as a symbol of how much time has passed?
I didn't, except just in the sense that he's constantly going back to tattooing himself.
Hmm.
But I think that works.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially if you want to take the tree tie in. It's very interesting, too. A cyclical time is huge in this, both that death leads to rebirth, which leads to death, which leads to birth. Future Tom is recognized as the first man in the Mayan temple, or first father, but he's also the last man.
Mm-hmm.
So we're supposed to accept that they are one and the same.
Why is Future Tom the last man? Earth is gone?
Yeah, I mean, that's the implication.
So anyway. Earth is gone. He's only alive because he's been eating from the tree of life?
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would have never thought that he... I mean, he could have easily just been a regular space traveler.
I mean, you could take that view, too.
What makes you keep calling him the last man?
Well, that's what the movie was originally titled.
Oh, well, that will do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think he's ever actually called that in the movie.
Yeah.
But certainly within the script, which I haven't read, but within the production notes, that's how Aronofsky thought of him.
But how do you get that from that? Just watching the movie?
It's an interpretive jump if you're just taking the movie.
Oh, I mean, I like it.
Yeah.
So
you could at least take it in this is that even if we say, okay, Earth's still back there and people are still living on it, he dies in this apocalyptic event, so he is symbolically the last man in that future storyline, mm-hmm. even if he isn't literally the last man.
Because that nebula is going to hurt Earth?
No, but he is the only man alive in the middle of an apocalypse.
Oh, okay. Okay,
there you go. He becomes symbolically the last man, okay. who then begins the cycle of rebirth in this new galaxy that's formed.
Okay, I like
at
that.
At the end of the movie. Abandonment is a big symbol in this movie. In every storyline, Tom slowly loses the people around him. You know, his men as the conquistador mm-hmm. lose faith in him. He alienates them. He alienates his colleagues in the mm-hmm. present. Eventually, even the tree dies. He alienates himself from Izzy. So this sense of even and he does it again, paradoxically, in the name of resisting death, which is sort of the ultimate abandonment, the ultimate solo journey.
Mm-hmm.
But he more or less puts himself in a very dead-like position through his resistance of death.
That's interesting.
So it becomes a very paradoxical figure.
Okay.
I'm losing my voice. Okay.
Take a drink of water.
I'm going to take a drink of water.
Yeah, let me go see if I have any more notes that I could add in here. Well, Donovan did not see him being a monkey coming. You know,
it's one of those spoilers we talked about.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah,
so.
It just becomes a monkey.
Yeah, and so they're working on this guy. Nope, not a guy. It's a monkey.
Yeah.
So I wrote a little note. Donovan is a monkey.
How about that?
All right. Why don't you take it back to the symbols?
Okay, so here's a good one. Did you catch what Tom and Izzy's last name is?
No, I did not.
Creo.
Is that creation, or what does it mean?
No, it's Latin for I believe.
I was way off.
So Tom goes from Thomas the Doubter, doubting Thomas, to Thomas the Believer.
How do you know he went from... What do you mean the Doubter, Tom? Oh, you're just saying...
There's a parallel between him and the biblical figure of Thomas.
Okay. So his last name means...
Thomas, I believe.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
You were asking about why is Izzy always bathed in, or why is she always wearing white?
Yeah.
There's these strong symbols throughout the movie of religious ecstasy. For example, at the beginning when she's saying, come take a walk with me, it's the first snow, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. As she leaves, she departs into a doorway bathed in light
mm-hmm.
where he stays behind. Symbolically, she has accepted her death. She's in a place of peace and enlightenment as a result of it. She is inviting him to come with her into that place. He refuses. He stays behind in the mundane world where she departs into a place of religious ecstasy.
That's good. And all that is because she has come to terms with her death and she is okay with whatever comes next.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's accepted that... death is a part of her humanity.
And who first says it's the road to Ah?
Oh, man.
She says that she heard it from somebody, right?
Yeah.
Is it from the Mayans? Or?
She hears it from the Mayans and she writes it into her book.
Okay.
So there's this sense throughout the book, or throughout the movie, that yes, death, the paradox of death in the movie is this. That yes, it's something difficult and painful and tragic. You know, the cancer is not a good thing. The Inquisitor is not a good thing. But yet, they are... impossible enemies. You can't overcome them. And so death is seen as both something that has to be accepted, but also as an essential part of our human nature.
Mm-hmm.
One way that you can read the ending scene with the Tree of Life and Tomas is that he does get immortality, but he loses his humanity in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense of that even if we are to succeed in this and become immortal, we would fundamentally lose who we are as humans, that this side of Eden overcoming death is not something that we can do and remain human.
Okay.
Which is a very, very fascinating religious idea to consider.
You talked about sacraments earlier. Was the scene where he was helping her take a bath, is that any sort of baptism there?
Oh, man, you could see it. I hadn't thought of that, but you definitely could go down that road.
What's then the... Why was he helping her? I know, because she was sick, but not so sick that she couldn't have done it herself.
I think it's symbolic of their intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her vulnerability, his closed offness. You know, there's... she's obviously naked in the tub, and he's fully clothed. So you see her willingness to just be completely vulnerable, completely open. She's carefree, joking in that scene. He's cold, depressed, worried. And so it's a very strong contrast between the two.
If it is a baptism, how is it a baptism?
Oh, man. I'd have to think about that. I'll see if I have an answer by the end of the episode.
Okay. Read on.
Another case of religious ecstasy in symbolism. When she has her stroke in the museum, there's light coming down from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
She lifts her eyes, stares into the light. Her expression on her face is not pain or suffering, but enlightenment.
Well, she said she felt filled, I think.
Exactly. Exactly. So she is experiencing not death, even though that's what's physically happening to her. She's experiencing something greater to death. She's experiencing this sort of afterlife or religious ecstasy or rebirth or a taste of what's going to come for her in that moment. It's a beautiful scene, the way it's shot.
Mm-hmm. There were a few different scenes like that where they would look up and there would be something above them in the ceiling or in the sky. And I felt like every time they were looking up, they were looking towards the nebula. Is that true?
It could be. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, what do you think they were? Because why was that continued? Like there were different shots where they would look up like that. Is it all supposed to just point us to God?
That would be the obvious interpretation, that it's just a basic religious symbol.
Why does this guy who doesn't believe in a God...
That's a good question.
...continually have... Well, maybe not continually. I haven't seen the Requiem for a Dream or Pi, but this movie and Noah point towards a creator that I think Christians can get on board with to a point. I mean, there's obviously some stark differences, but...
Sure.
But he's pointing us to a creator that's not that unfamiliar.
They're profoundly religious films.
Yeah.
And not just because, you know, leave out the fact that Noah's based on the Bible.
Yeah.
Even if it had been an original story.
Mm-hmm.
These are profoundly religious films.
Yeah. So where is that coming from inside him?
I have no idea. It's fascinating, though, because he's making... And it's not just this, you know, we take some religious themes and make an interesting story. These are very, very thoughtful movies that are saying really powerful and thought-provoking things about religion and about life and about God and sacrament and all this stuff. It's incredible that he's able to produce this as somebody who's an avowed atheist. And then one final piece of that religious ecstasy, Tom experiences the same thing, future Tom does, when he finally accepts death. He looks up, he's bathed in light, he literally floats out of his spaceship
into a little tiny bubble.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Some future technology to look forward to.
Yes.
And again, is bathed in light as he dies in the nebula.
Wow. All right.
Now, here's a couple other things. Just some small ones, but this is fascinating. I noticed this today. So in the past storyline, remember Hector Salamanca comes in from Breaking Bad? Mr. Okay. Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, right.
So, oh, yeah.
I
didn't recognize him.
Yeah, so the priest is the guy from Breaking Bad.
Okay.
He comes in, and he has the map for how to find the Tree of Life in Central America.
Okay.
And he pulls out a knife and says that's the guide. You know what else in the movie looks exactly like the knife?
Give me a hint.
Something in the present storyline.
I give up.
The pen that Izzy gives to Tom
looks
almost exactly like the knife. Both are a guide on how for him to complete his quest.
Hmm.
In the past storyline, it's to find the Tree of Life. In the future storyline, it's for him to find peace. Because she knows that through him completing the story, he is going to find release. He's going to find the same type of acceptance that she's experienced.
Okay. Interesting.
Let me see what else I have. There's We already mentioned the thing of how the hairs on the future tree match those on Izzy's neck. In each of the three storylines, there's parallel shots of the conquering hero riding off to go beat death. So we have Tom speeding his car down the interstate. We have Tomas galloping his horse out of the castle. And then we have the spaceship flying through the air. What's interesting about these shots is that they all begin upside down. Okay, so we see they begin upside down. We see Tom coming toward us, and then it flips and goes right side up.
I didn't remember that at all.
Yeah, it's the exact same shot in all three storylines. What that means, I don't know. I think you could interpret it as that Tom, we see him upside down. In each case, he is shown with purpose and determination, but there's something fundamentally wrong about his quest, even though he's doing it for noble reasons.
So what does that mean then? What's wrong about it?
That he's trying to beat death
in
a way that would take away his humanity.
So it's just, they're showing us with the upside down camera that he's on a good mission, but it's actually bad?
He's on a bad mission for good reasons. That would be my take on it, but I'm sure there's other interpretations. There's a lot of shots like that, actually, if you just watch the three storylines, where Aronofsky will repeat the exact same shot three different ways. It's brilliant.
All right, what else? I really want to hear the Noah.
Let's get to Noah. Okay, so you already mentioned the seed. Then there's this whole idea of the last man. Now, I mentioned that the fountain was originally called The Last Man.
Mm-hmm.
But that line shows up in Noah as well.
In the movie?
Yes.
Where does it?
Remember when Noah's having a little powwow about how I'm going to die and then blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. And you'll be the last man?
Yes. He says to Japheth, you will be the last man.
Yeah, I remember that.
That is so fascinating because I feel like with that line, Aronofsky is inviting us to draw parallels between these two movies.
Did you do that when you first saw it?
When I first saw Noah?
Yeah.
Yeah, that clicked with me. The second I heard it, I thought he's referencing the fountain there very deliberately.
How? I don't quite see it.
Well, it's the same way, is that the last man in the fountain exists in this apocalyptic event, whether you take that as the death of Earth and he's literally the last man, or just the apocalypse of Xibalba exploding.
Mm-hmm.
Japheth is the last man in the similar apocalyptic events. And so there's a sense of Aronofsky wanting us to ponder what happens to humanity when the last man is the last man, when there's one person left alive. What does that mean? What is that experience like?
So they don't necessarily tie together. It's just a recurring idea that Aronofsky wants us or presents us with.
That is just a recurring idea. Here's where they tie together very strongly.
Okay.
Noah and Tom are parallel characters who are nearly opposite in their trajectories, but their character journey takes the exact same beats. Okay? So check this out. Noah shows a fanatical level, and this is movie Noah, just
to
be clear. Noah shows a fanatical level of devotion to the created order, to respecting God, respecting what he believes God wants, and respecting how things ought to be. Tom shows a fanatical level of devotion in the exact opposite direction. His entire quest is to overcome the created order, to deny God, in a sense, because we are invited at the beginning of the fountain to see death as God's penalty.
Wait, I have a line here. He says about death. Death is a disease.
Yes.
There's a cure, and I can find it.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have the same type of character pursuing this fanatical quest, if you will, but in very different motives or for very different directions. So Noah is, this is what God has said. This is what it's going to be, and we will do whatever we can to make it so. And Tom is saying, no, this is the world I live in, but I refuse to accept that, and I will overcome it. Okay?
Okay.
Noah is at peace with that throughout his journey. Noah is at peace with how things are. Even though it's horrible and everybody's dying, he accepts it and he lives with it. Tom is tormented throughout his journey until the end, and then they switch places. So once we get to the point where for Noah, it's the moment he decides not to kill his, by the way, spoilers for Noah, his granddaughters.
Yeah.
For Tom, it's the moment where he says, I'm going to die, and accepts it. That's the turning point for both characters. Noah then is plunged into despair while Tom is plunged into peace.
Mm.
So they both accept it. And then finally, both characters are ultimately forced to examine the other side of what they believe and find peace in it. So Tom is forced to ultimately accept the fact that he can't overcome the created order. And he finds peace in that. He accepts it. He dies and his journey ends. Noah is forced to accept the fact that he got things wrong or that he failed, or however you want to read that, that things were not how he thought they were supposed to be. And he finds peace in that and accepts that. And that's the final scene of Noah where he's reading the covenant.
All right. Wow. That's crazy.
And that's, you know, I'm sure if we went back and rewatched Noah a few more times, we could probably find a lot more. But mark my words, when Aronofsky would not have included that line in Noah about the last man if he wasn't inviting us to look for these kind of parallels.
Do you think it's possible he sees them existing in the same universe, these two stories? Because he has the creation story, or actually I think the beginning of The Fountain has more of the fall story, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, in similar visuals to depict the Bible. So we've got Noah telling kind of the beginning of the world. We've got, then if Tom is the last man, it's the beginning of humanity and the end of humanity.
Right.
Together, possible?
I think you could read it that way. I don't think Aronofsky intends it, because I don't think he thinks about stories that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be if Kevin Feige was put in charge of this. We'd now have Noah Fountain movies planned out to 2076.
Yeah.
But I think as an interpretive exercise, you could certainly see these two movies mm-hmm. as very much being parallel, very much set in the same universe.
That's interesting. That's very good. I think my favorite thing is a seed, because I picked it up myself.
Well done, well done.
But I like what you
have
here.
That was a good find on your first viewing.
Thank you.
I was impressed.
Yeah. Well, I just saw both movies pretty recently.
Well, I watched The Fountain twice this week, and I didn't pick that up till my second time.
Thank you. So,
other thoughts from your initial viewing or our conversation?
Well, yeah, I don't think I would have put together the fact that the seed was from the tree of life necessarily, unless you had helped me out there. So that's interesting to think about the ramifications of that. It's basically the garden then was existing inside that spaceship in a sense.
Right.
It wasn't just the tree of life. It was the last remnants of Eden.
Yes.
That's crazy. I don't know. That's good. That's good stuff. I saw you skip a little bit of your notes. Did I make you pass anything when I had you go to Noah?
I had things written in different sections because I wasn't sure what order we were going to say things in.
That was a good talk. Yeah, and I think this was perfect coming on the heels of the Noah talk. So
Darren Aronofsky, genius.
And so for the other two movies he's done?
Three. Four.
What are they?
The Wrestler, Black Swan, Requiem for a Dream, and Pi.
Which of those would you recommend?
Pi. I think that's an interesting movie.
Is that the one that's about drugs?
No, that's Requiem for a Dream.
Okay, what's Pi about? Try to sell me on it.
Jewish mysticism, numerology, weird stuff.
Would I like it or not like it?
Probably like it.
Do you want some notes about what Aronofsky himself said about this
movie? Yeah, let's hear it.
So straight from Wikipedia. Now, we've talked about our view on it. Do you want in a 2012 interview, he gave what he thinks the movie symbolizes. Do you want to know this or do you want to not be exposed?
Oh, no, I want to know it. Yeah, absolutely.
He says that ultimately the film is about coming to terms with your own death.
Yeah.
And he wrote it, this has a long story. Do you know some of the behind the scenes stuff in the story about how Warner Brothers
had gotten cancer?
First, Warner Brothers greenlit this movie.
Right.
And it was supposed to be starring Brad Pitt and Kate Blanchett.
Yep.
And then Brad Pitt backed out because he wanted to change something in the script.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't. And so once he left, they basically shut down production. And then over that time, then, like you were just saying, his parents both at the same time got cancer.
Yeah.
And so then he was dealing with trying to face death of somebody close to him. I don't think he was married at this time, but he was dating Rachel Weisz, who was in this movie. And so then he cast Hugh Jackman, but the studio ended up casting Hugh Jackman after they re-greenlit the movie, with some tweaks. He made it more of a low-budget film. And then I think it was Hugh Jackman who encouraged him to cast his girlfriend, or his then-girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, who's Rachel? I think Rachel Weisz is married now to James Bond, Daniel Craig.
Yeah, because she was married to Aronofsky for a while.
Oh, they were married.
Then they got divorced.
Sad news.
And now she's got James Bond.
So, yeah, so it is interesting that he was facing the death of his parents at the same time as kind of tweaking the script a little bit. So, all right. I am ready for your story time, unless you have more you want to say.
You know, I think it's just worth noting what a great performance Hugh Jackman gives in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, and gosh, I wish he could just be done with doing Wolverine stuff. He's so much better in these types of roles.
Do you remember when Aronofsky almost did the Wolverine?
That would have been interesting.
Considering what we got, which I consider one of the worst superhero movies I've seen.
Yeah. It couldn't have been worse.
I would have loved to have seen Aronofsky.
Absolutely.
Do it. He'll never do it now.
No.
I think
him away from comic book movies.
Hugh Jackman's starting to talk about who's going to take over for Wolverine when he's done. I think he's getting sick of it, too.
Yeah.
I bet we'll see the end of him doing Wolverine maybe in two more movies. I think he'll do another Wolverine movie, and I think he'll do one more X-Men movie after Days of Future.
So you think he'll do Apocalypse?
I think he'll do Apocalypse and Wolverine 3, and that's
it. Yeah, I think you're probably right.
All right, here we go.
It's sci-fi Christian story time.
Now, you teased us a little bit in the last episode.
I did.
Or was that the beginning of this one?
The last episode.
And you said that you saved the life of one of our listeners.
I did.
And our friends.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, we do a lot for our listeners here on the show, Matt. I mean, we provide compelling thoughts and entertainment. But up until this last week, up until Sunday night, I'd never saved the life of a listener before. Now, when I say save the life, I, of course, mean I gave somebody a ride home, but as you'll find out, it's more or less the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's 8 o'clock at night. It's starting to get dark, and I get a text, and it says, "Ben, it's Casey. Are you home?" I was like, oh my gosh, what's going on?
Yeah.
So, I text her back, yep, I'm here. And so, seconds later, I get a call. She is stranded on the side of the road because her bike got a flat tire.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I went and heroically threw her bike in the back of my car and drove her to her home.
That's awesome.
Now, you might say, Ben, you didn't save her life. She could have just walked home. And technically, that's true. Technically. But remember, it's getting dark.
Mm-hmm.
She could have gotten lost.
Kidnapped. Who knows?
Run over.
Yep.
All sorts of terrible things can happen when you're trying to walk your bike home in the dark.
With a flat tire.
Who wants to do that? Not me.
It could have been some critters that attacked her.
Yeah, plus she would have had a solid 4-mile walk.
Wow.
Back to her house. So, yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and call it. I saved the life of Casey.
I think that you deserve this, Ben.
I think I do, too. It feels good to be a hero.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I was going to say we should maybe do another installment of the X-Files next week, but next week is episode 250.
That's true.
So we have to come up with something a little bit better than that.
And plus, I'm not going to have time to watch it this week because I'm going to Chicago.
So we'll talk off the air, but something big coming next week for episode 250. But for now, that's all from
Ben DeBono Beer Show crossover.
Oh, look back at the news episode to find out about the Ben DeBono Beer Show.
Yeah.
A new YouTube special that Ben's putting together. Ben's going to Chicago for C2E2, so if you're there, Facebook him. You can meet up, maybe.
Unless it's already happened by the time you listen to this.
I should try to get this up pretty quickly. what are some of the notes? Make sure you listen to what we talked about at the beginning of the last episode, the news episode, so you can put in your vote for what you want to be our next top 50 countdown.
Yeah.
Ben, give me an idea. First thing that comes to mind when you think of what will be our 250th episode.
Oh, gosh.
Something big.
Something big.
No, I'm saying that. Oh. I'm telling you, it has to be something big.
I have no idea. Something I don't have to do a lot of prep for since I'm going to be in Chicago.
Like a top five or something like that?
I think a top five is an over. Maybe a top 50.
You want us to do a
Should
top 50?
Should we do 15? A top 50 of something?
Next week, we'll each come with top 50 something. I don't know if that's... I don't think we'll be able to put that together.
The top 250?
Should we rank the last 250 episodes?
I don't think that's a good idea.
All the news at the bottom. Nope, at the very bottom, History of Christianity.
That's true.
and then some of the listener feedback episodes, because I don't know if you remember this, but when you're off the air,
yeah,
when you're on hiatus from the Sci-Fi Christian, I split up news and listener feedback both into their own individual episodes.
Yeah.
So I'd have like a backlog of 2 months of listener feedback, and I'd do it all in one shot.
Nice.
Not a lot of comments on those.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll come up with something. If you have any ideas, email us at
feedback@thescifichristian.com.
Or you can call us at
612-4121-SFC.
And one more time, let's hear it for Ben DeBono. So long, folks.
Hey, goodbye. Ben DeBono, an American hero.
All right, we're back. We shut everything down. I was exporting the last episode into a form of media you can listen to. But guess what? Ben reminded me we didn't give it our top five, which we have to do.
You mean our five-star rating?
Yep, our five-star rating. Out of five, I'll start.
Okay.
There's a part of me that wants to say lower than three, but after our discussion, I can't say anything lower than a three. So three-star, but I think it has a lot to do with what I said at the beginning, where it made me kind of feel bad. It didn't make me feel good. So
could you give two separate ratings?
Yes.
One for your experience of the movie, one for the quality of the
movie. My experience was a three. Artistic value, five.
All right.
Go ahead. What's your rating?
Five. I think it's one of the greatest movies ever made.
I thought so.
Yeah.
All right. So one more time. Let's hear it for Darren Aronofsky.
A true American hero. Just like me. Darren, you're welcome on the Ben DeBono Beer Show anytime.